And right now, time to welcome technology commentator Steve McCabe. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Catherine.
A lot has been written, said, broadcast, tweeted, blogged about the death of Steve Jobs, his contribution to the rapid development of new technology of late is obviously stands in its own right. A lot of the discussion now, of course, is can Apple continue and continue as it has without him as the driving force as well as the face?
Well, I think one of the most important issues is going to be the aspect of the face. I can't think of, in recent years, anybody who has become quite so identified with his company and his product as Jobs did. He has become very, very much identified as the public face of Apple. And since the late 90s, he was the man who would be at the forefront of all the product unveilings. He was very much the man who represented the company in the public eye. And I mean, in the last couple of years, obviously, they've started to move away from this a little bit. But still, people have always said, well, is Steve Jobs going to be there? And now that we know that obviously he never will again, there is a concern about, well, what else won't be there anymore? That's the big question. And since about, I think, 2007, it's been pretty obvious that Apple have been grooming two or three other fellas to try and take over from him in this public front capacity. And we saw this, when was it, a week or so ago, when Apple unveiled the iPhone 4S, which is coming out this week. We started to see how they're handing over to Phil Schiller, to Scott Forstall, to a fellow named Eddie Q, who is starting to emerge as a leading figure at Apple. And we're starting to see, I think what we're going to see is Apple moving away from these big public displays because they haven't quite got anybody anymore who's got the same rock star presence that Steve Jobs used to have.
I wonder, though, that they certainly know how to build anticipation, and perhaps they overbuilt it in the case of the iPhone 4S, mm-hmm. which was released last week. But is that's a critical part, obviously, of getting your product out there. But is the real genius that's becoming increasingly evident was simply his ability to envisage and then drive through every stage right up to marketing and the selling of the product?
Well, that
what the new gadgets were going to be, is that the bigger loss in reality?
There is a potential for that, obviously. And I think it's worth looking at the fact that Steve Jobs has, in effect, left Apple twice over the years. The first time round was obviously not in any way of his own volition and totally not managed by him at all. That was when he was ousted from the company back in the 80s.
Well, apart from the fact he was trying to run a coup against the CEO at the time.
Well, yes, he did somewhat bring it upon himself. We realise that. But obviously, When it happened, he was on the receiving end of everything that went on in terms of his actual being booted out of the company. As a result, at that particular time, his influence within the company was clearly waning. And when he left, it was very much a case of, right, he's gone, we need to move away from him now. And when he came back in, was it 98, I believe, things were not going well for Apple. There were some people who were suggesting the best thing they could possibly do was give the proceeds to shareholders and just shut the company down. Now, obviously, that was not what he wanted to see. Turn the company around. Next thing you know, he's making his second exit from Apple. And obviously, again, not really what he was looking for. Certain circumstances, obviously not. But this time, he stage managed it. He made sure that when he left on his own terms. It was done in a way that he designated. He'd made his mark. It was now his company, not somebody else's, very, very strongly. And he had a successor in there, or a number of successors, that clearly he had anointed, and more importantly, the public could see that he had anointed.
Even more than that, there is talk, and again, this is a company and an industry that thrives on hype, mm-hmm. but there is talk about existing gadgets to be unveiled in the coming year or 2 years that are already... if not done deals, are already in the process of production and that are going to be big hits again.
Oh, without doubt. We know that in corporations like this, and Apple can't be unique in this regard, the development cycle for any given product is going to be longer than the year that we see between one iteration and the next being released. We're expecting to see, say, an iPhone 5 or whatever it's going to be called released at some point in the next year. realistically can expect that somewhere in California there's somebody working on an iPhone 7, 8, who knows? But what we see is obviously only the tip of an iceberg.
I guess what I'm saying is I wonder if he had left a significantly game-changing, is the word being thrown around, product ready for the first launch that would happen post his time there.
Well, quite possibly, yes. And one of the things that Apple are very good at is secrecy. It's quite possible that they did. And given that the man must have realised that his time was coming, it's quite possible that he's got something set up and saying, look, fellas, here's what you do to make sure that people realise that my end is not the end of the company.
You've mentioned those four big names that were talked about as being the frontman, the showman that is so associated with Apple and with Steve Jobs. But really, is the most critical role seeing before they do what the public are going to want, designing these gadgets that for whatever reason people want more than others or have wanted more than others, and who is in charge of that design side of things that was seen as being the core of the success?
Right, the fellow you're talking about here is a chap named Jonathan Ive. He's a British-born designer who was brought into the company and brought through the company by Jobs. And you won't often see him being trotted out at these presentations. He's famously a very, very camera-shy individual. But he's, in his own way, every bit as obsessive and detail-oriented product designer as Steve Jobs ever was. The two fellows clearly were born to work together. And it was Ive who really drove this very, very minimalist, this very clean, very elegant, very stripped-down design that Apple have refined over the last 10 or so years. He's very much the product designer. And the sense you get is that Jobs would come up with an idea. We need to make a phone. And then Ive would be the guy who would spend months and years deciding exactly what exactly the refractive density of the front glass had to be. The fellow is minutely detail-oriented. He's fantastically obsessive, but never really gets pulled out because he doesn't really want to be in the spotlight, for what we can tell.
When we talk about, people have used names from Edison to Henry Ford, and obviously their significance was taking what are now absolutely ubiquitous products and being part either of making them possible in the first place or bringing the first mass versions to market. Can we really talk about Jobs in the same breath when it comes to this kind of new technology?
To a certain extent, yeah, I think Henry Ford's a fair comparison. People were making cars back then, and people were cobbling things together and calling them motor cars. Henry Ford was the one who refined the system, obviously created the production line, and made cars ubiquitous. But I don't know that necessarily he had the same product flair that Jobs had. The analogy that I think is most telling, that I've actually heard very few people reference, is Walt Disney. You've got a man there who was extraordinarily tightly identified with a very, very creative company. And when he died in the late 60s, the Walt Disney Corporation, and I mean, how tightly identified with a company can you get the naming it after yourself? But the Walt Disney Corporation had no idea to begin with what to do. Suddenly, their guiding light and their creative spark in particular was gone. And this was while they were still in the process of building Walt Disney World in Florida. But what had happened there is you had a company that very much knew who they were because they had a very clear leadership and a very, very strong guidance from a strong individual. And as a result, they were able to tap into what they knew of him from what he taught them. And as a result, even though I think it's fair to say that the direction that the Disney Corporation finds itself travelling in now couldn't possibly be identical to where Walt would have sent them had he stayed alive. Obviously, you can't say we'd be identical to his vision, but it certainly cleaves fairly closely to where he was sending them.
Well, how much is an iPad, by the way, at the moment, the latest version thereof?
iPad in the US, $499.
So here it's, I'm trying to do the maths on that, still $700 or something like
that. Or thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah. You are now going to talk about a tablet that costs $30. Is it the same sort of thing?
Well, that's a very, very good question. Thereby hangs quite a tale, yeah? What we're discovering is that over the last few years, we've basically taking it as axiomatic now that if you want to do education, you have to have some form of computer in a student's hands. It's reached the point now where we're just positing that statement as being true. And we've seen this being developed with the one laptop per child program that's been gaining ground around the world. There's a couple million of those in circulation now. But in India, they're taking a substantially greater step. The one laptop per child machines are costing around $200 to produce. But India have just announced that they are going to be producing a $30 tablet for students.
And what do we know of it?
Very, very little, I think is probably the fairest thing to say. Including, and it has to be stated very clearly, whether or not it even actually is going to exist. And we can discuss the details of that very shortly. But it's an interesting little thing that's going on there. It's being developed by a British company called Datawind in cooperation with the Indian Institute of Technology in Rajasthan. And they're saying that they're hoping to get this in the hands of about 10 million Indian tertiary education students. It's going to be a very stripped down system. It's going to be running the Linux operating system and the OpenOffice software package as a, shall we say, an alternative to paid products like the Windows operating system and Microsoft Office. So it's going to be a fully fledged, apparently, tablet computer that's going to be put in the hands of students because, as I said, it's now an article of faith that if you're going to be successful as a student, you have to have a computer.
And of course, this brings us to the whole question of the digital divide and the haves and the have-nots when it comes to access to this kind of technology, particularly in education.
Well, exactly. And that's exactly where the Indians are going, which is, I mean, the digital divide phrase was the language that a fellow named Kapil Sibal, I believe his name is pronounced, he's the Indian Minister for Human Resource Development. And he's talking about this digital divide, and he's saying that this device, they're calling it the Akash, which apparently means sky. This tablet supposedly will end this digital divide.
Has it been tried before to make something that mimics what the flash new gear is, but trying to do it in a much lower cost way?
Well, it's been tried. The Indians in particular have had a go at it in the last few years. In fact, it's interesting that Minister Sibal is the one who's fronting this particular project, because a couple of years ago, he was also promoting what was apparently going to be, if you can believe this, a $10 laptop. This is 2009, it was. And again, this was going to apparently revolutionise Indian education. And this turned out to be an abortive prototype for a handheld computing device. Went nowhere, never materialised. And so even though we're now hearing that this Akash device is going to bridge the digital divide and revolutionise Indian education again, presumably, we're kind of waiting.
Waiting to see if it happens.
Well, exactly. So I've been reading up about this ahead of today, and I've been trying to get a straight picture of what exactly it is. Some people are saying that basically it's the same thing as this putative $10 laptop that never existed. Some people are saying that it's already available, being sold as a $60 device under the name UbiSlate. No one's quite certain. It seems to be, at this stage, unfortunately, the ultimate in vaporware.
The idea of laptops in kids' hands has been around for a little while now in several countries, actually. And how far has that got, that concept of every child being able to have access to a laptop or having their own?
Well, it's gaining ground, certainly in the richer parts of countries like the United States, for example. Yeah, schools don't have to demand it. It's just provided. You're getting a lot of American universities are providing iPads, for example, to incoming college students, university students. Now, obviously, the students themselves indirectly will pay for that through tuition fees, but that's gaining ground there. And because this is creating what we're calling this digital divide, we're also seeing movements like the one laptop per child model, where people are trying to put computers in the hands of communities who otherwise wouldn't stand a chance of being able to fund them themselves. So it's gaining ground. I mean, the one laptop per child system has actually funded 2 million machines so far. The Indians are talking about doing 10 million of this Akash device. So the will is there, clearly, and it's starting to gain ground.
What about in this country, where certainly there's been, obviously over many years, moves to get kids access to computers in classroom, but the idea of having your own individualised tablet. Some schools, we were talking earlier in the year, some schools now moving to make it basically compulsory on the stationery list. Are we still having the argument over why and whether it's necessary yet?
You know, it's interesting. As I was putting together my ideas for this morning, I got thinking about this, and suddenly I realised that every time I tried thinking the idea through, I was realising that basically there is an assertion being made every time that kids have to have computers. And it, as I say, it's an article of faith. It's dogmatic at this point. Kids have to have computers. And it almost seems to me at some point that the question will, why isn't really being asked because, well, kids have to have computers, don't they? And we're not really taking the argument that next step and saying, well, do they actually necessarily really need them? And as I've said before, you know, the old Luddite that I tend to be, I'm thinking back in the 70s when I was in school in the 80s, we didn't have computers and I did just absolutely fine.
Yeah, world's changed a little bit since then.
Exactly.
Are you seriously asking yourself that? Have you come up with reasons why not? Which is the other way of turning it around, isn't it? To those who say, why, I say why not.
Well, yeah, basically, I think the question hasn't really been fully asked. The debate has been sidestepped. We're simply making the assumption, well, yeah, computers, you've got to have computers, haven't you? I mean, there is a wonderful line from the first Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy book where Arthur Dent's house is about to be demolished to make way for a bypass. And he says to the bloke who's trying to demolish it, well, why do we need a bypass? And the fellow says, well, it's a bypass. You've got to have bypasses. And the logic never goes any further than that. And it occurs to me that this is a wonderful Arthur Dent moment where we say, well, it's a computer. You've got to have computers. And then the question becomes, well, do we really? Are we then just saying, well, it's a computer, and then saying, well, great, we've got a solution, right? Where's there a problem for it? And there's a little bit of that going on, I think.
Interesting stuff. We might pick up on it again. Very quickly, BlackBerry, the government and server failures. There's some problems at the moment, are there?
Oh, massive problems, yeah. BlackBerry is this ubiquitous, or at least it was earlier in the century, this ubiquitous cell phone device where email gets pushed directly to your device and you get a warning popping up saying, you've got email waiting for you. And for these hyper-connected people who are very important and need to be getting their email the moment it comes in, it was brilliant. And it's become a very, very major player in the telecommunications industry, a company called Research in Motion, an Ontario company. The problem that's happened is that because of this push technology where the email gets sent directly to the device, you don't have to go and check for your email. Email has to go through the company's clearinghouses. They have to have a central server that says, oh, there's an email that needs to be sent to this person's device right now. And it all goes through Research in Motion's servers. What's happened, unfortunately, this week is that one of their major data clearinghouses, one of their sorting houses for all this mail, it's located in Slough in the south of England.
Oh, my God, it's The Office.
Exactly. It's actually yes, it's
certainly... It is The Office.
It is indeed, and clearly managed by David Brent because it's failed. It's gone down.
Simply because of what, over excessive volumes or what?
Well, this is one of the things where Research in Motion have kind of become their own worst enemy. They've not really been willing to address the problem very, very clearly publicly, so we don't quite know what's gone wrong. Excessive volume is an entirely reasonable guess. Companies need to grow and they want to get more customers. It's possible there's just too much traffic and it can't handle it. It could simply be that something just went kaflooey on the server. It happens at the best of times. But the thing is, this started on Monday, British time, and apparently, rather than being resolved, it's actually getting worse as we speak.
Four continents now affected with BlackBerry users losing email messaging and browsing service, I'm reading.
Well, that's right, yeah. I mean, it started off with... They actually started using an abbreviation I hadn't seen before, EMEA, which apparently stands for Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. And they that was the region. That's a huge area, if you think about it, that's affected. And now it's spread to Argentina, I heard, and it's starting to affect...
Brazil, Chile.
Yeah, it's starting to affect customers in North America.
Well, can they handle it? You're suggesting perhaps they are not handling it very well so far. Who are Research in Motion, anyway?
Research in Motion are a Canadian company. They're based in Waterloo, Ontario.
They're the BlackBerry makers.
They're the company who developed the BlackBerry platform. It's their own proprietary system. And they were, to begin with, in the early 2000s, they were Canada's next great hope for taking over the tech universe. And they started really scrambling when the iPhone came out because, oh, lordy, this is going to be a massive competitor for us. But their big feature, like I said, this push email, where notifications appear on your phone saying email is waiting for you. It's like having the postman coming knocking at your front door instead of you having to go and check at your postbox every 10 minutes. This was quite a big deal. And Apple's implementation of that has always been very, very weak.
You believe there's some significance for this for New Zealand right now. Is this because there's a bit of a very high use BlackBerry, I think, isn't it, in the corporate world and also what in government as well?
Well, I think Research in Motion were desperately hoping that they were going to see some major corporate government action here. Apparently, the reports coming out at the moment from Computer World are saying that the New Zealand government are soliciting bids now. They're putting out for tender a government-wide telecommunications implementation. And that's going to be a big customer to have. You know, we're looking at a couple of hundred government agencies, 70-odd local councils. There's a lot of business to be had here. And so Research in Motion obviously would love a piece of that. And apparently, from what we've been reading, certainly for very sensitive, security-sensitive traffic, Research in Motion's BlackBerry platform is the New Zealand government's basically only preferred vendor, which could mean that they could get this entire contract. And suddenly, with this little fiasco going on, that could jeopardise the entire thing.
What's the mnemonic again?
EMEA. EMEA.
EMEA. So when it's EMEA and Z,
Oh, Lord. We
start worrying.
Let's not go there.
Thanks very much. That is our new technology commentator, Steve McCabe.